On today's episode, I'm joined by theatre producer, film programmer T.A. Quinn, and PhD researcher and goldsmith. Oh, there's a lot of ands.
Sorry. Just do it again without the... That'd be great.
I'm going to break this down. Hello and welcome. You are listening to Tell Them, a brand new podcast talking all things contemporary culture by black and brown artists, produced by Tamasha Theatre Company and supported by the people there at Transmission Roundhouse. My name is Toby Cheramarting and I'm the host for season one. On today's episode, I'm joined by theatre producer and film programmer Tue Huynh and PhD researcher and Goldsmith Associate Lecturer Miranda Armstrong. I'm ready to hear what these ladies have to say, so let's get into it. Out to me. Hello ladies.
Hi.
How are we doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. How's everyone's week's been? What you been up to?
It's been a bit of an assault course. I've been teaching. I went to see the play that we're about to discuss. I had parents' evening as well.
Oh. Were they well behaved?
Parents' evening. I was meeting my son's teachers.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. But it's been good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I've had a pretty busy week. Just working on a play I'm producing, being at uni, studying, working on my research paper, which has been blowing my mind.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Pretty for long weeks.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what I've done. You know, you know you've done a lot, but you don't know what you've done at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's been my week.
A blur. You just don't want to tell us, do you?
Secret information. Thanks for joining me this week. I'm really excited to have you both on. So we're going to talk a bit about Stop and Search, which is at the Alcola Theatre, written by Gabriel Badamosi. Tell me like initial thoughts, initial feels, initial things that kind of jumped out to you in terms of like what you saw and how you felt about it before we go really into everything else.
I guess I'll start because Miranda's pointing at me. You go first. Feels. I guess for me, I felt it was quite a frustrating play. I think there was a lot of issues that they were trying to address, but I felt like it didn't really delve deep enough into them. I felt like, so it's in three chapters, and the first one was really interesting, where you had... A character called Tell, who's like this, I guess, white working class man who decides to pick up a refugee to take him from Calais into London. And they have this really intense conversation, and it's predominantly focused on Tell, the white man, and it's just frustrations in life and his anger. And the only reason why he takes in Akeem, who is the refugee, is because he's tired and he doesn't want to fall asleep whilst driving through the tunnel. And I just felt like, you know, there was this whole thing about like, you know, because he mentions in the conversation that he voted.
Yeah.
And, you know, we thought we'd get a sort of, I don't know, an insight into the climate of Brexit and how people are. But it just kind of skimmed over it. And I felt, I wasn't sure about this.
Yes. I think with there being a migrant character, we were hoping to hear a bit more from Akeem. But as Tue said... Tell the white character basically dominated the conversation. So Akeem was almost there.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
And it just felt like you wanted more of him because he was really calm. And like, I thought it was really interesting how the conversation went where Tell, he and his parallel of like talking about the issues that they had themselves. So he was talking about domestic issues and how frustrated he was and how angry he was about those kind of things, whereas Akeem was talking about memories of, you know, seeing people die and his journey into life. And I thought that was a really nice sort of like parallel and conversation, but we weren't getting enough of Akeem, which was a shame really, because it appeared that he was going to be a really interesting character, and I felt like that carried throughout the entire play.
He had a kind of strong but quiet presence, and he seemed a bit more nuanced than the white character, but Tell's voice was allowed to dominate, unfortunately. Frustrating is a good word for it, I think.
I think something a few of the reviews seem to be picking up on is about the I guess the role of Akeem in this piece and how he's portrayed, especially considering the writer is half Nigerian himself. And I think most of the reviews were talking about how it feels like he was used as a tool or a kind of, side piece.
Apologize.
As opposed to being a more kind of fleshed out character. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that. I think, Miranda, I think it'll be good to hear your thoughts considering your research and the things that you're working on at the moment as well. But I think generally in terms of how characters like Akeem are explored in this, in these kind of work, and I guess the nuances around that.
I think there are two other black characters in the play, and there's a black transgender police officer, and then a black woman at the end, and they're not really fleshed out. You don't really get to hear about their histories, how they feel about their present very much. It's hard to know what the point was. Tue and I discussed how there seemed to be a desire to say something, but the message didn't really come through.
What do you think that message was meant to be, or was trying its best to be, if you could think?
I mean, I don't know. When I told Miranda my thoughts, and she's like, I don't know. I just felt like, because I found it interesting, it was written by a British Nigerian man, and these voices in those characters just weren't really heard. And I don't know whether he was going for like that, bam, okay, so this is still the case here in the arts, that like these voices aren't being heard. But I don't know, it's just a bit of a stretch of just trying to understand why these characters weren't given enough. I don't know, it was just, it's frustrating because it's hard to, I guess, gauge what happened in those 90 minutes.
Oh, ho, brother, ho, whoa, now.
But I think it's relevant though, because I think there is something about the role that the arts has, well, the arts and media has to play in kind of attempting to accurately reflect our society, whether it can do that depending on the people that are making the work, or the people that I guess dominate the media to the largest extent in terms of trying to accurately reflect our society.
I don't know, because I was thinking about, you know, how does the arts accurately sort of tell stories, and I think the word accuracy isn't really correct, because I think every creative has their own voice and their own perceptions and their own interpretation of things. And I think you can take strands of truth into something, but they're always going to be interpreted from that person. And when they're taken into, I don't know, onto stage, into film or whatever, the viewers are always going to interpret it differently. So I think accuracy isn't really, I don't know if it can be achieved in the arts that way.
Yeah, I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
I think there will always be a truth to how people's own personal views, upbringings, etc. will aid in how they see the world. And how they navigate the world and how they see other people specifically. But I think there is an accuracy to certain things, and I think that accuracy can be missed if the work isn't being made by those people, for example. We see in the media a lot, with a lot of different agendas being pushed about different things. And that is probably the truth of the media and a lot of people out there, that they think this is definitely it. And yeah, I guess, I don't know, to what extent do we say, okay, cool, this is your truth, and I can understand that and I can respect that if it's something that might be damaging to a wider part of society.
I think, just going back to the play, I think the characters could have been more fleshed out. And I think that could be about people coming from particular perspectives and seeing people from particular groups in a very one-dimensional way. So we had this transgender man and we didn't know much about him besides that. So a person having a particular trait and that defining them as a whole person, rather than them being fully fleshed out with characters or of colour, a trait that they have will define them completely rather than them just being an ordinary person.
Do you think there's a pressure to make work that reflects us as creators of colour, as artists, specifically non-white. Do you think there's a pressure to make work about that? Like you were just saying, in terms of there's one characteristic that tends to like define the character, as opposed to it just being a kind of, I'm going to the shop and I'm buying a pint of milk because I need some milk.
Yeah.
And not, I'm going to the shop and I'm black. Mm. And I'm buying some milk and I'm black. And then I buy milk and something happens. Yeah. Like, do you think there's a pressure on artists of colour to make work that does kind of surround that specific trait as opposed to anything else?
I think there's a responsibility to tell the truth and to accurately reflect experiences. I don't think that people have to be representing blackness all the time as black artists. I think it's important to show realities that don't get shown. But I think black people also need to be portrayed as just human beings as well. I think there's a freedom, but I think there is a responsibility to try and counter stereotypes as well. So there's a mix, but I just think, yeah, just don't reinforce stereotypes and don't reinforce caricatures.
I completely agree. But I think it is quite hard to do that. Mm. And I think just in the arts, it's like, you know, you want to break, like you are going to try and break those stereotypes, but there are these stories that do need to be told about our reality and the world that we live in.
Yeah.
And I think those are like the conversation starters for now. Mm. And I think, you know, it's got to get to the point where, you know, things are normalised and people are normalised and people from different sort of minority groups are normalised.
Mm.
And that we don't have to tell these stories where it's specifically designed in that sort of way for that particular group of people.
I think there's something in this about audiences as well. And I think, you know, what happens when you do make something that is culturally specific, but it goes in front of an audience that doesn't quite understand that. And I'm thinking back to an Octoroon, for example, that was at the Orange Tree Theatre and then transferred to the National Theatre. There were a lot of conversations around that show because of how culturally specific it is. And I think that's more culturally specific in a very kind of American way. Did either of you see the show?
I didn't get a chance to, no.
Yeah, so it's an interesting play. I saw it and I didn't hate it, but there are a lot of people that did hate it, and I could understand why they hated it as well. But I think that show is written for white American audiences to really look at themselves and to really have some kind of personal accountability, basically, over the history of America. And I think when you take a show like that and it's put in front of a white British audience predominantly and a black British audience because they want to support the writer who is a black writer, there are things that become lost in translation.
Mm.
So there's work that is culturally specific, but sometimes it's put in front of different audiences. I think 2A specifically, I wondered if you had any, because I know you're producing a show at the moment that's going on at the Park Theatre. What has been your thinking around, I guess, audiences and who you want to come and see that work and actually how that work might translate to different audiences that aren't maybe the people that are at the forefront of who you might want to see it?
It's a really good question, and it's something I've been working on for the past month in terms of understanding how audiences work for this kind of work. So the play I'm producing is called Summer Rolls, and it's about a British Vietnamese family, predominantly focusing on the daughter, and it's a family drama, and it's about, you know, coping with identity and coming from, you know, the parents who come from Vietnam to Britain and bringing their sort of children up in this Western world, and how do you cope with a dual sort of identity? Mm. And in terms of audiences, like, so Park Theatre, it's in Finsbury Park, and I've been there a couple of times, and predominantly the audience is white middle class and of the older generation. I mean, I want a lot of people to see, and not just East Asians, British East Asians, but I want to see everyone. Like, it has to be a mix because it's a story that everyone, I think, can relate to. Because you look at the themes, and like, even though it's in the backdrop of a Vietnamese family, it's a story about like having secrets in the family, communicating with yourself and how you identify with yourself. And I think everyone has had that issue, no matter what background they've come from. You know, you look at a play and it's like, oh, this is written by a Nigerian person, so you know, this is just like, oh, I have to understand because, you know, I'm Nigerian. It's like, well, no, look at the story.
Mm.
It's a backdrop to a story that everyone could relate to.
Mm.
So that's the message I'm trying to do with Summer Rolls. And I think that's really important. And like, only yesterday I presented it to a group of Vietnamese refugees. And their sort of reaction to it was just so surprising. These people have never been to the theatre. So one goal is to get people who have never seen themselves on stage before. But then anyone who comes from like a second immigrant sort of background, they will get it. And they will follow that story.
Mm.
And I think that's that's the beauty of art in terms of reaching out to those kind of audiences. And the white middle class will always go to the theatre. They'll just, their perceptions hopefully will be widened and they'll be open to stories like this, but not to say, well, this is how Vietnamese people are. This is how British Vietnamese people are. Mm. That's not the case.
What you said reminded me of something when you were talking about, you know, someone being like, oh, it's, you know, written by a Nigerian and so I might not get it as because I'm not Nigerian. It reminds me of an article that I read by a musician called Nabiha Iqbal. She's British Asian and she had a stage name called Throwing Shade. She does a lot of kind of like electronic indie music, but she changed her stage name to her actual name and released an EP, and this white reviewer reviewed it and was like, oh, I don't really get a feel of Asia.
What?
And his whole review was basically that it just wasn't Asian enough for him really like get into it. Yeah. And so she wrote a response piece that was like, it's electronic music and it's indie.
Yeah.
That's what you're meant to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were like, oh, well, you're Asian, so... And it just reminded me a lot about that. And I guess like the expectation from those audiences that, like you said, will always go to the theatre, will always go and see work, but also might approach it in a way that's like, oh, well, I couldn't understand it because it's not my experience.
It's just, I don't know. I think the arts, like the role it has is just, I don't know, like I'm just studying quite a lot in terms of what is the purpose of it and what does it do? And in my opinion, I think,
a big topic.
it is, but it's something I'm actually really starting to try and understand, because, like, you know, being producer of theatre is one thing, but also curating like film to audiences as well, and trying to understand the dialogue between, you know, the film and to people, and what does that do? What I want it to do for me is to create a stir inside me emotionally, mentally, and to start conversations with people. You know, that's the power of art, really, is to actually start engaging with what you see with people who see it too. Everyone interprets things in a different way, and like if you can bring that conversation to someone who's interpreted it in a different way, you've started something.
I want to get more into the whole academia stuff for my personal interest. I don't consider myself an academic. I didn't go to university or anything.
Don't do it. It's hard.
I think like the breadth of things that people are researching at an academic level at the moment, hopefully will create more kind of access to a different way of really analysing and looking at things. Mm. But I want to kind of talk to you both about your academic journeys and the things that you're studying at the moment. Miranda, you released an article, Media Diversified, incorporating your research on stereotyping of black boys and their parental upbringing and all the jazz that people are saying. That to me is kind of like a focus point, something that has been happening, I guess, but is also overdue to me in a sense that actually that this is something that's been happening for a long time, something that's been stigmatized for a long time, but no one's really thought to look at in an academic sense, because people are just like, oh, this is just the way it is.
Yeah,
this is just life, and there's no need to really research. It's not worth researching. It would be good to hear more about the kind of things that you've been researching and the things that you've been looking at, and also why you wanted to start that in the first place.
Well, my research is about single mothers who have raised their sons to adulthood in the inner city, and I focused on black families because of, like he said, the negative narratives around that family dynamic. So there's the narrative about so-called absent fathers and the effect that that has on boys being raised by their mothers. I decided to focus on this because I'm a single parent myself, and when I found out that I was going to have a son, I felt that it was an impossible task. Even though I wasn't educated at that point, I knew just from the implied kind of points made in journalistic articles about crime and stuff that, you know, there was this implicit link being made. And when I returned to education, when my son started primary school and started to look more deeply to try to find that information about how families had made this work, because when you look at statistics, it would be like, oh, around 50% of children of single mothers are more likely to have these negative outcomes. So I was like, so what about the other half? There was no contextual information, like, this is why. It was just like, oh, it's because of the family structure and that's it. And there wasn't any information about how people had made the, you know, how they made this family structure work. So, yeah, I decided to look into it myself, but not look at people at the same stage as me, but speak to mothers who'd raised their sons to adulthood already and capturing their reflections on the experience, and then speaking to the adult sons of mothers and asking them to look back and feel like, you know, do you feel like you missed out on something, or what was it like being raised by a mother? What was it like growing up in inner London? And yeah, actually, like you said, speaking to people, because there is that assumption that, oh, it's just the family, and that's how, you know, that's how it is.
What's been the most thought-provoking anecdote or story, or something that someone has said that you've, that might have shocked you or surprised you or made you think a bit more about the kind of research that you're doing?
Yeah. Do you mean from my participants, or like what's being said, like in kind of the public realm?
Maybe both. Maybe both.
Okay, I don't know if I should go there, but at the moment there is a black male professional, he's an educationist called Tony Sewell, who has been writing a lot and making a lot of appearances on news programs. I believe he was on Channel 5 News in the past couple of days, and he is arguing very strongly that the rise in knife crime is down to the prevalence of single mother households. It's a narrative that he is being very persistent with. He wrote a book 10 years ago, and now
a whole book.
it's not just about that. The book is about his charity and his work with African and Caribbean boys and supporting their educational achievement. But he spends a lot of time talking about the dynamic between single mothers and their sons. And there's a bit of misogyny in there.
Absolutely.
He's said that the boyhood of black boys is actually over-feminized. And he says that they run to the streets because they're trying to get away from their grandmothers, their mothers, and their female teachers.
Wow.
He says that young men look to the streets for male role models and to learn about masculinity. The thing is, he's not alone in this. There have been similar comments from David Lammy.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Didn't he write an article that was basically saying...
So in his book, he released a book quite quickly after the 2011 riots, Out of the Ashes. And even though he doesn't specifically say young black men, from the descriptions he's using, it's clear who he's talking about. And he said, like, young men who participated in the riots had no one to steer them through manhood, and that's why they're lost to a nihilistic culture. It's quite concerning because there's a very reductive link between the prevalence of single mother households and the people that are being affected by street violence, and just making a very oversimplistic link without looking at much else. So, yeah, it's a very easy, convenient explanation. But something that, from my research, suggests it doesn't have any basis, because people have a wide variety of experiences in these families. So you can't blame the family structure.
Stuff like that also, I guess, comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about, like, the role of the arts and media in kind of representing our society, but to a wider society, and actually how accurate it is. And I think there's something interesting in this particular conversation about, I guess, the way that people are talking about single mothers, and that narrative coming from these two black men that are talking, that are saying, or have said, David Lammy has switched up a bit now, but, you know, have said that that is the reason. Ture, it will be good to hear about your, you're doing your master's at the moment.
I am indeed.
And I'm really interested in what you're studying. When I always think about academia, I always think about really giant, holistic topics that have lots of words in them that I don't understand. And
that's very true.
About things that I don't really understand and all of this stuff. But I always think it's interesting when people pursue, I guess, like this level and beyond of something that still has creativity at its core. So I'm really excited to hear about.
I'm glad someone's excited.
I'll be excited for you.
Yeah, oh, thanks. I think my excitement died after my first three essays. No, it's hard work. So my master's in film programming and curating. And what I'm learning and researching is just basically understanding the dialogue between films and how you put that in front of audiences and different sites of exhibitions and tracking, you know, what is absent and what is present in the cinema. So looking at archives and just looking at historical sort of journeys through that. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this was because in the last, I guess, year and a half, I've been really exploring my own identity as a Vietnamese person. And being like an avid sort of cinema goer and theatre goer, I feel like there's not much out there that sort of like speaks to me. And like, you know, I've programmed on a side before, and where I haven't at that time really explored my Vietnamese and Chinese side, I'd never really thought about programming or curating films for spaces and for people. So it's actually really interesting to try and put my own personal sort of interest and passion into something academically. My research thesis, which is still in its initial stages, but I'm looking at racism in Hollywood and looking at Vietnam War films as a case study. But as my research goes on, I'm really starting to discover that it could be a chapter rather than a whole headline, and just looking at, like, you know, the presence of the representation of Vietnamese culture in film, but also the absence of it. So I'm really interested in what's not actually there and what is there, and trying to understand like theories behind that and applying that to what I'm interested in. And it's fascinating. And I only just, while I was waiting in to record this podcast, I found that there was a animation made in the 1930s in Vietnam, and like just before, like, you know, Vietnam was being colonized by the French. And I'm just wondering, like, where do these films sit in the world now, and how can we bring those to the surface and be aware of, like, what Vietnamese culture is in the arts? Because that didn't really exist, and Vietnam was never really a country where it could be free enough to be creative, and that's what interests me. And to get the academic sort of knowledge and background to cement in what I do creatively is really important to me. And I think, yeah, like, there are a lot of books and essays that I'm reading, there's loads of like academic jargon that I don't actually get, but then when you get it, it's like, oh my god, this is magical, and you can really apply it to your own personal interests. And I think, I don't know, academia is important, and I've been wanting to do it for a while, so yeah. So if you wanted to do it, Toby,
I think you should.
I think it's definitely, I don't know, I was talking to Miranda earlier on, like how fruitful it is, and just to have that in your, like, just to read and take in material and like just to learn about what exists academically and apply that. It's just, it's really rewarding. But don't get scared of it. Because it does sound really scary, and I think everyone can do it. It's just, how do you do it for you, you know?
I think at the moment there have been quite a few conversations about diversity, the D word.
I hate that word.
That word, in academia, and actually how that can affect the way that people learn, or even the topics that people write about, you know, who's grading them, who decides, you know, what's accurate, what's not, what's relevant, what's important, all of that stuff. And in your kind of academic lives, do you think either of you have come across any of those kind of hurdles of I guess being in this very institutionalized space and trying to talk about these two very specific topics?
I was lucky at undergraduate level. I was actually really fortunate to be in a department that took my perspective seriously. But I know that that's not always the case. Just through going to student events and talking to other people, like, some people have said that they felt nervous to write about race-related, race and inverted commas issues. And just to play it safe, would leave it out. And I think from their, like, assignments and essays, and I think that's a real shame, because it's an opportunity, like you say, to make sense of things and to explore things deeply. and, you know, you're there to learn. And if you can't explore and reflect on and articulate your own experience using theories because you're not sure whether it will be accepted or valued or rewarded, it's wrong. You pay so much money to do this. And I think it's a real travesty.
No, it is. And I think, I don't know, I guess I'm just going to talk broadly rather than my own personal experience. But is that as a person of colour walking into these institutes or walking into the arts, I think there's always this, I don't know, this fear that you're always going to be questioned and you always have to work harder. And it's tiring. It's really tiring. And it's kind of like, but then you know, then you start to question yourself. Like, am I being too sensitive? Am I being a bit emotional about this? But then sometimes things happen and it's just cold, hard facts that, like, you know, you are struggling because of who you are. And yeah, I find it really hard. You just have some experiences. I don't really want to say what they are, but, like, just, you know, it does make you stronger and it makes you more determined to just do it. Because I've never met, like, an academic that is Vietnamese and in a creative sort of sense as well. Mm-hmm. And I think with all my struggles, I'm just going to try and, like, battle through them. And then when I get there, I could be the visibility for the other generations who do want to do it. Mm. Not saying I'm going to change the world, but, like, it's just hard work.
I was going to ask, Randa, because you're an associate lecturer as well. Mm. And for some of your students, probably seeing you there, it had an impact in itself. Like, in my whole schooling, I think I had one black teacher for a couple months and then she left.
Yeah.
When you go to secondary school in Tottenham, that doesn't happen.
Myth.
All of my teachers are black.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah.
I had
that's
one.
So interesting.
I had none in primary school. The one in secondary school then left.
Yeah.
Like, after me being like, yeah. She was a math teacher and I didn't like maths, but I was
oh, yeah.
Finally. Yeah. And then none again at college.
Yeah.
Apart from someone that came in and, like, introduced me to Debbie Tucker Green and then left. But that was great.
They were a blessing. And
there's a statistic here that between 2016 and 2017, there were 25 black women and 90 black men among 19,000 professors in the UK.
Crazy.
I can't say it without laughing because it's actually
crazy.
Ridiculous. Is there something that you think about in your role as an associate lecturer, like, at all, in terms of just you being in that space, but I guess being on the other end to the students?
I can't presume, I don't know, presume what effect it has on them. But I know for me going through, if I had seen somebody like myself, like teaching and doing research, that would have been amazing for me. I didn't have that. Yeah, during my undergraduate degree and during my master's, yeah, I didn't see anybody like myself. Mm. And when I was coming to the end of my undergraduate degree and thinking, yeah, I really want to carry on and pursue this, I did have a moment where I was thinking, will I be seen as credible in this role? Will I be taken seriously? Do I have to change the way I speak? Mm. I remember I was looking at a particular member of staff as they taught and thinking, I'm never going to sound like you. I'm never going to look like you. I don't want to, but...
Hey, well, I don't want to look like you.
But, you know, I don't want to change myself, but will me, as I am, still, you know, be seen as credible by staff and students? As long as I'm clear, as long as people learn from me and I'm clear, I don't have to change my accent. You know, as long as I'm bringing knowledge that people find useful, that's my role. But I just remember very consciously that thinking, you know, I don't look like, you know, the people in this department. Mm. You know, can I make it? And so representation is so important. And it's not about just having people there to encourage the next generation. Obviously, that's important, but it's not about having those people there tokenistically. Mm. Different people bring different perspectives. Mm. And I think that's something that I missed out on particular modules, thinking that, you know, these certain debates like the sociology of gender. And there was a week where the focus was going to be gender and race. And I was like, great, intersectionality. And it was a time when intersectionality was being debated quite hotly on Twitter and stuff. And it wasn't mentioned at all because the person that was teaching, just it wasn't their interest. So people, academics get to shape courses as according to their interests, which is great. Like, you get like such a spectrum of ideas, but that unfortunately means that if certain people aren't teaching, students don't get that perspective. And it, you know, it makes the course poorer for it, because you're not getting a rounded view of the world. It's just very partial and incomplete. And then that gets reproduced when they go into whatever areas they do, because there's just that blind spot that has never been filled in.
Yeah, reach out to me.
To round off, if there was a nugget of advice...
That question.
That you would give, just give out to the world in relation to what we've been talking about today, what would that be?
I don't know. I think it's like, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tiring. And you're going to be like, you know, the times where you just want to give up. Oh God, it sounds really generic. All the people who question you, society or whatever, you know, that's going to bring doubt into you. And like, when you're starting to feel low and like all the pressures come in, I think the main thing is to try and enjoy that process. I know that sounds really silly, but like, to embrace the bad times, so that will help you grow into understanding what goal you're trying to reach. And I think that like, you've got to keep going with it, because the impact you're going to make. I'm boring Toby, she's starting to yawn. The impact.
It's 10 p.m, you know.
I know, it's late. Yeah, so the impact that you're going to make with those struggles, embracing them, is going to affect, like, you know, tons of people after you. So just keep going.
Yeah.
Sorry, that sounded really generic.
No.
But yeah.
And I think what I have to say just follows on from that, like, that it's okay to be different. I think the importance of telling your story in whatever way you can, and bringing your unique perspective to whatever it is you do. I'm sorry if that's so brief.
No, that's fine. Short and sweet. I like it. Stop and search lines blur between conversation and interrogation. Three conversations grow increasingly uneasy. A new play by award-winning writer Gabriel Bradamosi, exploring a time of distrust and our deep ambivalence about the way we police each other. In Gabriel's words, the play opens the question of why a tactic aimed at policing drugs, violence and terrorism, and that stops 7 black people for every 1 white person, has grown into a flashpoint for wider and deeper flaws in a volatile and frightened social psyche. Gabriel Bradamosi is an Irish-Nigerian poet and playwright with direction by Arcola Theatre's artistic director Mehmet Ergun. It plays at the Arcola Theatre until the 9th of February. Thank you so much for joining me, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening.
Reach out to me.